This is Steve Sherlock with another series of podcasts for Franklin Matters. In this session, we'll cover the budget workshop held on January 25th, 2010. This is part 6 of that series. In this particular session, Assistant Superintendent Sally Winslow will cover the nuances and the requirements of providing special ed for the Franklin schools and what it means to the budget. So without further ado, let's pick up with Sally Winslow covering. In the next session, we'll get into Beth Fitzmaurice as she gets into more of the details around the special ed portion of the budget.
Okay, so what Beth and I are here to talk about with you is special education. We want to give you really an overview of the school district's responsibilities, both programmatic and budgetary, and so that you can have an understanding of what our requirements are under the law and the associated cost drivers that make special ed such a big ticket item in the overall school budget. So I'm going to do the general overview piece and try to give you that conceptual framework about special education, and then Beth is going to speak more specifically about special education as it pertains in Franklin. The special ed services for kids are mandated by both federal and state regulations. Some of you may have heard of IDEA, which is the special ed law. Some people call it IDEA to make, use a little anachronism there. But in 2004, it was reauthorized, so now it's the new and improved version, the Individuals with Disabilities Education Improvement Act. And the focus when they reauthorized the law was really on providing students with disabilities with access to the general curriculum. And you're going to hear this language throughout the law. There's also a state law, which we used to refer to as Chapter 766. In many cases, you'll still hear it referred to as that, but it's this really exciting title, 603 CMR 2800. What you need to know is that special ed is mandated. It's required by federal regulations, and we also have state regulations, and at a minimum, the state regulations have to be what the federal baseline is, but state regulations in some cases can actually exceed the federal requirements, and we would be required to follow the higher standard if that's the case. We have a lot of alphabet soup in special education. You may hear a concept called free and appropriate public education, or FAPE. That's what we're required to provide for all students, and we're required to do that within what's called the least restrictive environment. This is really the basic underpinning of the law. The spirit of the law is that kids with disabilities do best when they have access to the curriculum in inclusive settings, so that when they're with non-disabled peers in the general ed classroom, and that they have a right to the same level of challenging curriculum that all kids get, and that includes state and district-wide testing. So in the eyes of special ed law, taking the MCAS test is a privilege and a right that special ed children have. Some basic assumptions. There's a few things we want you to walk away with tonight around special education. One of them is that it's kind of a moving target. It changes. Can change from day to day, from month to month, from year to year. Because we have to be able to provide services to kids with a range of needs. So you might have children that have very low needs. They might just need some related services like speech and language, like occupational therapy, maybe some academic supports. And then you have kids with really, really complex needs that need a one-to-one aide, a one-to-one nurse, vision services, all kinds of things. And that those needs change continually. One of the things that you will notice is that most kids will receive their services, and they will access the curriculum within inclusive environments and within the school district. But we do have children with more significant disabilities low incidence populations that we will need to have some really highly specialized programs that we cannot provide in our own school district. They might need outside placements. One of the things I do want to mention also is that sometimes inclusive programs, developing a program for a child within our district, can actually be more costly than some of the outside placements that we would provide. And, you know, that's one of the things that we're constantly juggling when we're making decisions about programming for children, because we're always wanting to make the best decisions for kids, and we're trying not to break the bank at the same time. And sometimes in-district programs can be much more costly and a better thing for children to do. A basic tenet of special education is the team. And the idea is a team that gets together of educators and parents that know the child the best. And if the child's 14 years old, they can be a part of the team as well. But it's parents, children, if they're 14 and older, the general education teacher should be a part of it that knows the child and the curriculum well, special ed personnel who work with the child, some building administrator or central office administrator who has the authority to commit the resources of the district, sometimes outside people, maybe a counselor that works with the child might be involved in an educational team. And what the team does is they develop an IEP, more alphabet soup, which is an individual education program. And that includes the services the child requires to access the general ed curriculum. And the last piece is a placement piece. After we develop an IEP for a child, then we talk about where that IEP services are going to be delivered. Is it going to be delivered within a general ed classroom? Are there going to be some services within a small resource room within the school? Are there going to be services somewhere else? We only talk about outside placements for children after all options with the school have been within the school have been exhausted, because we're always looking at the less restrictive environment. I also want to mention that the research does show that kids do better in inclusive settings with typical peers, and that's one of the things that we try to do whenever it's possible. The first thing we do when a child is referred is we have to do evaluations. We have to evaluate the child to determine if they're actually eligible for services. And the list that you have up on the screen is a list of the types of assessments that we may do on a child when we're evaluating them. What we do is we evaluate in what we call suspected areas of need. So we wouldn't necessarily do all of these evaluations on any child who's referred for services, but we might do if the concern is that the child has a difficulty with expressive language or oral formulation of language. We might do a speech and language evaluation. If they're having difficulty with academics, reading or basic skills, writing, literacy, we might do academic achievement assessments to include reading evaluations. So the team makes decisions about what kinds of assessments that we're going to do based on the needs of the child presents. Sometimes we have specialty evaluations that we might need to conduct on children, that we have to go outside to have those evaluations done. And those are things that can be costly. If you have a child who has a visual impairment, for example, we might have to have an orientation and mobility evaluation done, or a vision evaluation done. Sometimes we might have to have, when we have someone providing services, providing evaluations, and within our own district, they're out sick for an extended period of time, we might have to contract out to get that completed, and those things can be costly as well. And after we've done all our evaluations, what we do is the team comes together to determine if the child has a disability. The categories you see behind you are the federally defined categories that we look at, and they're descriptive, educational categories. They're not diagnoses. We're not in the business of diagnosing autism, for example, or intellectual impairment, but we can do some assessments that might be indicative of those categories. And we may not actually talk with parents about getting some additional outside assessments done, medical assessments done, to confirm something like autism, for example. And then, when we determine, we go to determine eligibility, and the reason why I'm walking you through this process is I want folks to walk away with the understanding that we're not just like, you know, putting kids on IEPs and randomly and just sort of spinning the magic wheel and deciding if kids are eligible or not. There really is a process in place. The law is in place to protect kids, but it also protects school districts as well, because if we're following this process and there's some integrity to it, then we're going to be making good decisions, good educational decisions, and that's going to also impact budgetarily upon us. So in your packets, you also have this, you have a document that looks like this. That's a special education eligibility flowchart. We have a nice large one here for those of you who have really excellent vision and see that far away, over here to the right. But that really, this is, shows the process that we need to go and follow at any team meeting when we're determining a child eligible for services. The child has to have a disability in one of these categories. If they do, then you have to demonstrate the fact that the child is not making effective progress in school, and that lack of progress is due to their disability. It's not due to something else, some other thing that might be going on in the child's family or life that might be causing them not to make progress. It has to be related to the disability. And then the last piece is that the child has to require special ed services or specially designed instruction in order to access the general curriculum. And there's that phrase again, access the curriculum, that we keep hearing. And then there's a continuum of services. And there's another chart that you have in your packets that looks like this
on the back.
Oh, it's two-sided. Maureen was trying to save another tree. And this is an IEP placement page. And this sort of describes the continuum of services. This one is for children that are 6 to 21 years of age, but there's actually a form for kids that are 3 to 5 years of age. And if I didn't mention it, I don't think I did, but we are required to service kids who are eligible from ages 3 to 22 or until they graduate from high school. Okay, so we actually have, there might be preschoolers who are on IEPs right up through, if they're more significantly disabled, they might be with us until they're 22 years old. So our in-district programs, full inclusion program on that sheet, the placement page that I just showed you, it talks about the amount of time in the general ed curriculum. A partial inclusion program, you're a little less time in the general ed classroom, you have more services outside of the classroom. Substantially separate classroom environment is, we have several substantially separate programs within Franklin, which we'll talk about a little bit in a moment, but those are programs where the kids spend the majority of the day in those classrooms getting their services. Then you have your out-of-district programs, and there's several types of those. There's public day school, and what we did was we actually put the budget line item so that when you're actually looking at a budget, you'll see
the really big numbers on our budget.
Right,
9,000 is.
And Beth will address that now. She what that's looking like for this year. But the public day schools, the 9,100 line, educational collaboratives is the 9,400 line, and so forth. But there's also private day schools, residential schools, and some kids are actually in highly specialized programs out of state that might be approved for us to send them to.
When you say out of state, you're not necessarily talking about Rhode Island, just a drive, are you? You are.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, as opposed to a
there are residential programs out of state.
There are some highly specialized programs that are in New York, Rhode Island, or around the area that we may access. Our obligation under the state law is to exhaust all of our opportunities within the Commonwealth first. And if we're not able to find some place that's appropriate to meet the needs of that student and help them to access their curriculum, then we would start looking out of state, absolutely.
And where we're located so close to Rhode Island, that might be a more cost-effective option to have a student go to Providence than to some of the schools that, you know, might be out in the western part of the state. And when you get into some students with intensive disabilities, the programs are few and far between for some of those students.
And additionally, if a student needed to access a program outside of the district, then on a day basis and they're traveling back and forth, again, that makes Rhode Island a little bit more of a logical option to us here, because there's also an obligation to try to keep a student within 1 hour traveling. That's also some regulatory guidance that's in the document as well. So quite a few different things that we take into account when we start looking at different options once the decision's been made that it's not appropriate for that student to access their curriculum within our district.
Okay, thank you.
So to recap where we've been so far, the IEP team evaluates the child. There's like really three major functions. They evaluate the child. If the child's eligible, they develop an IEP. The IEP is written to describe the recommended services that the child needs to access the curriculum. And then part three is we decide where those services are going to take place, the placement piece of it. I did mention educational collaboratives. I'm not sure how many of you are aware of what collaboratives are, but I thought it might be helpful. They are really public entities, and they're comprised of member school districts who decide to join forces to develop cost-effective programming for some low-incidence population. So, for example, say Franklin has two children a really low-incidence disability, and it's going to cost a heck of a lot of money to develop that program for two kids, but King Philip has a couple of kids, and Medway has a couple of kids, and we say, hey, let's put a program together, all of the towns, and we have we can do this in a more cost-effective manner. So that's what a collaborative does. We belong to two collaboratives. We belong to Bi-County Collaborative and Accept Collaborative. And, you know, so the Bi-County Collaborative is some of the towns more in this neck of the woods, so Franklin, Bellingham, King Philip, Mansfield, Foxborough, Plainville, this area, and then Accept is more Metro West. So Medway, Holliston, Hockington, Framingham, Dover, Sherbin, and Millis out that way.
It gives us better buying power and a broader range of programs for students, so we're not locked into just one region.
Right. And mostly the collaboratives will run programs that are substantially separate programs. If you remember looking back at the placement page on the IEP, and it has substantially separate classroom. Substantially separate programs are those that are run within public school buildings. So even though it might be a program that's run by the collaborative and it's in a public school building, those kids, and they spend the majority of the day in that classroom, they still have inclusion opportunities. They still might be able to go into the cafeteria at lunchtime, maybe take a gym class, an art class, a reading class within that public school setting. We do have some collaborative programs from BICO Collaborative located within our school district at Andy Sullivan and the high school. And that's added a great deal. When you have a collaborative program within your public school setting, it really does add, I think, to the richness of the entire educational experience for all kids.
And they pay us a small bit of rent.
And they pay a little revenue on top
of it,
which doesn't hurt. But there are also public day programs that collaboratives run, and those would be in a separate building. That there's not a school program that's run in that building. So, an example I can give is a school building that might be closed down in the town, and then then a collaborative moves in and pays rent, and they have kids that are going to school there because they really can't function real well in a public school setting. So it's a step away, and they don't have the inclusion opportunities to the extent that kids within our public schools do. Okay, so that is the underpinning piece. I'm going to switch places with Beth. If you have any questions for me, if you want to wait till the end, and we can do them all together.
Thank you for listening. For additional information, please visit franklinmatters.blogspot.com. If you have questions or comments, you can reach me directly at suresteve@gmail.com. The music for the intro and exit was produced by Michael Clark in the group East of Shirley. The piece is entitled Ernesto Mañana, copyright Michael Clark and Tintype Tunes, copyright 2008, and used with their permission. I hope you enjoy.